So glad to see you all this morning. We're thankful to have you here with us. We're at the Boone Center for the Family Track. Some of you have been in some of our other seminars, but I see some new faces this morning, so we're really glad you're here. The Boone Center for the Family is located here on the campus of Pepperdine University, and we're committed to developing healthy relationship living. We have some marriage programs, but we also have a program for 18 to 28-year-olds called Relationship IQ. If some of you work in the church with either young adults or single adults, you might be interested in learning a little bit more about Relationship IQ. There's a program overview page at the back table if you're interested in learning about that. If you want to stay on the mailing list for the Boone Center for the Family, you have cards in your seats, or they're spread out among that. Or if you're more techie, you can text 228-228, and then you'll be put directly into our website and get a response from us, and you'll be on our mailing list. We're excited to have Adam and Kelly here with us this morning. It's an interesting thing. I've been in the field of marriage and family therapy for about 30 years, and my husband and I have been doing marriage seminars at churches for about 30 years. But the most interesting thing that's happened for me in the last 10 years is when we talk to pastors or leaders at churches about doing marriage seminars, they say, we've kind of quit doing marriage seminars because there's so many single people in our church, and they feel really left out when we do a marriage seminar and we don't have anything for single adults. And so we've even begun to change our marriage material a little bit so we can go into a church and do relationship seminars, because we certainly want to meet the need of all of the population of the church. Kelly and Adam have done a lot of thinking and a lot of work in the area of how to minister to singles in the church. Kelly's a visiting professor here at Pepperdine in the School of Psychology at Seabrook College. And I'm going to have to read about Adam because I can't remember.
I'll talk about
him. Yeah, he'll talk about himself. So, Adam and Kelly make a good team together, and we're just thrilled to have them this morning. So, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Sherry.
Well, thank you all for being here. Welcome and good morning. Very early morning it is to me, at least. All right, here we go. As Sharon said, my name is Adam, and this is my wife, Kelly. And obviously, we are not single, but we were very recently. Got married July 17th, this past summer. Actually, here on campus, over in the chapel, right over there. So, we are still close enough to single to remember what it's like and to care very deeply about the experience of singles in the church.
So, I had a decade of singleness after graduating from college. This was a very difficult time for me. Lots of unmet desires around romantic things, relationships, and uncertainty around if these unmet desires would ever be met. I'm thankful that God used his suffering deeply in my heart to learn about what it's like to walk with God in suffering. And I'm also thankful for how God used the church in my story during this season. There were a number of people in the church who I would say companioned me well during this time, who walked closely with me in the struggle. And church services themselves on Sunday morning were really helpful to me. I found church services to be a safe haven in the midst of suffering and difficulty. And as it turns out, my personal life has impacted my professional experience, and that I chose to research the emotional experience of single women as a part of my dissertation research for earning a PhD in family therapy at St. Louis University. I also have a Master's of Counseling degree from Covenant Seminary, and have counseled 8 years as a licensed professional counselor in St. Louis prior to coming to Pepperdine last year. And so I met with a number of single women as a part of this work, and I'm again here teaching at Pepperdine now.
I got my PhD on July 17th when I married her. By far the easiest way to get a PhD, and I recommend it highly. I received two master's degrees from Iowa University's Talbot School of Theology, one in philosophy of religion, and another in spiritual formation and soul care. And again, both of us care very deeply about this topic, and it's an ongoing interest, largely because of our personal experience in the church as single people for over a decade post-college.
So today, as we're speaking, we'll be drawing from our own personal experiences, the experiences of our friends and peers, our joint research on the topic, and my clinical experience and research. So from these sources, we know that fewer singles are present in the church, and if they are present in the church, it's less likely that they are fully integrated into the life of the body of Christ. And these trends are problematic, not only for the single person themselves is missing out by being a part of the church, and the church is missing out on singles as well. So our goal today is to paint a picture of the landscape of singles, what singleness can be like for some, and offer some helpful responses.
Yes, our hope is that if you came today, your heart is to minister to singles, and you maybe are aware that you're not as familiar with the internal life of single people in your congregation as you would like to be, or even as familiar with the culture and milieu of singleness today. We hope to give insight and information on that. And if you're here and you're a single person or otherwise deeply care about single people and have felt misunderstood or missed by the church, we're hoping today to give words to some of your experience. We don't claim to speak entirely for everyone or everyone's experience, but we're laying out a spectrum of experiences of single people as we've experienced it ourselves, heard from other people, and research has shown.
Okay, so to begin, singles are a growing and diverse group. It is a remarkable and staggering trend that since 1970, the numbers of singles in the United States have had a 350% increase. This is remarkable. So you may wonder, well, do singles no longer want to be married? Is marriage obsolete? No, in fact, research demonstrates that singles rate marriage as being very important or important, and are placing greater value on marriage itself. And the reason for this is that individuals are looking to romantic partners to provide more needs, more relational, emotional, social, and physical needs. So the importance of marriage is actually increasing. You may also be wondering, well, what is so difficult about finding a partner? That could be a conversation for another day. Lots and lots of reasons and factors for why it's harder to find a partner in this day and age. Also, only 3% of Protestant pastors have never been married, are currently not married. Only 3%. This largely underrepresents the population of singles. Singles are a diverse group. Singleness differs by gender, whether you're a man or a woman. Singleness is experienced differently if you have never been married or if you are single again. When we say single again, we mean individuals who are single after having been married and lost a partner to death or divorce. Singles differ in the extent to which they desire marriage. Some singles desperately want to be married, and others are truly content and happy in marriage. These individuals would be called to celibacy. The experience of singleness also differs by age, how old someone is. And in fact, the years 28 through 34 are called the limbo years. And these are years that individuals are beyond the average age for first marriage and are questioning if they are going to have the typical life trajectory pathway of marriage and children. It's uncertain whether or not that will happen. So the takeaways here are not to make assumptions about what a single person's experience is like, and to rather ask questions than assume. And also my hope is that the diversity of singles validates the difficulty that it is to minister effectively to singles, because this population truly is diverse and wide. So let's take a look at marital status in the United States. This graph represents marital status from age 0 to 90. So the green pictures people who are married. Now, let's make this graph better demonstrate adults. Now we've taken care of the 0 to 18-year-olds, so now we're looking at 18-year-olds to 90-year-olds in the United States. Again, green represents marriage. Purple represents an individual who has never been married. Orange is those who are divorced. Red is those who are separated currently. And blue represents widows who have lost their spouse to death. Now, looking at all of the singles in the United States, 60% of singles have never been married, and 25% are single, again, through divorce, and 15% are widowed. I want to highlight a couple more statistics for you from this graph. And the first is over half, in fact, 53% of 30-year-olds currently in the United States are single. Just not single again, but just never been married single. Moving to age 35, nearly a third of singles have never been married, 31%, in fact. Now, let's consider the population of those who have never been married and who are single again. For 40-year-olds, 35% of 40-year-olds in the United States are single. This is a lot of adults. Also including those who have never been married and who are single again, 30% of 45-year-olds are single. It's a significant number. Now, if you are fascinated by this data in this graph, a link to this chart can be found in your handout, and you can actually modify this graph by gender, region of the country, employment, and education status. So how do singles feel in the church? I would say a number of singles, not everyone, but many singles feel uncomfortably visible. So the church is a place where people typically attend with families, if they have a family. So when a single person walks into the sanctuary, they can feel very visible and exposed that they're entering alone. Or when they attend a church meeting, a church picnic, they can be very aware that they are attending alone when most people are attending church with their families. Paradoxically, singles can also feel highly invisible in the church. And this is particularly in reference to leadership. Singles report that they don't feel that their church leadership, pastors or other significant leaders, know them well personally or would consider them to be friends, as church leaders tend to be friends more with those who are married. So you can consider for yourself, if you're involved in a church, how many singles do you know deeply and would consider to be your own friends? And are singles represented in your church leadership, whether this is at the front on a Sunday morning? Are there singles who are praying or reading scriptures? Are singles involved in community group leadership? Are singles involved with Sunday school, etc.?
And again, we're not claiming that all singles feel this way at all times, or even all singles feel this way some of the time, but a large number of singles do feel this way at some point. Another way that singles can feel from time to time is less than, seen as somehow less than their married counterparts. That was, I think, the message that I received largely unintentionally at church, is that, you know, singleness is one of the most important things about you, and it's bad. It was a way to kind of highlight people and maybe pull them out from the whole body of the church, almost like it were a recovery community or people suffering some sort of handicap. The irony being, the church actually does a great job ministering to the recovery community and people with handicaps, by and large, I believe. But less so in my experience and the experience of people we talk to, the church. So one of the reasons I think singles can less than, or some sort of arrested development. Because in the past, marriage served as the cornerstone of adult life. It was sort of what launched you into, like, okay, you're a real adult now. That has shifted in our culture, whereas marriage is no longer seen as a cornerstone, more of a capstone. Once you've got your life together, once you've got your career, once you've got your education, once you've done basically everything fun and important you want to do, okay, it's time to get married. So, unfortunately, whether you think marriage is a cornerstone or a capstone, the message from the church and to some extent society is, if you're single, your life isn't well-ordered or it isn't complete. Tied to feeling seen as less than, it's seeming misunderstood. I felt this a lot. You must be having a great time. You're single. Something must be great. You must be miserable. You're single. Oh, that's terrible. People just assume good things, bad things. Oh, you must have plenty of time. You must have lots of freedom. All kinds of things about single people. But, you know, sometimes they're true. It's not like these assumptions came from nowhere. But it's not fun to get blasted with them all the time instead of having people ask. I particularly found this to rankle when I was in seminary. One of my programs, three of the faculty all got married when they were 19. And that would have been in the 1970s or 1980s. And I heard so much about what singleness is like from these people that got married at 19 in the 70s and 80s. These were wonderful people who I really liked. But I don't really think their experience has a lot to do with my experience. As a 30-something-year-old single in the 2010s. I did have a positive experience, not in the church per se, but with a counselor. I was sharing with a counselor how happy I was. I'm dating, it's just a drag, and this is awful. And I expressed that I felt some shame about it. Like, why am I not doing this right? You know, dating's supposed to be fun. And he looked at me and said, why would anyone think that dating in their 30s is supposed to be fun? And I was like, oh, I feel so understood. This is wonderful, yeah. But the message I got is like, oh yeah, dating's fun, it's great. If you're not having a blast and successful at it, well, something's wrong with you. So it's nice to feel understood by that counselor.
So other ways that singles can experience the church is feel that their struggles are minimized, is what Adam alluded to here. People don't feel that the church recognizes that singleness can be really hard and difficult. So these struggles can be minimized or even invalidated. So in culmination, these factors result in many singles feeling ultimately disappointed by the church. The church has not been a helpful or easy place to be. And there's a particular way that singles can feel disappointed by the church, and that is when they are struggling to find a partner or even someone to date in their congregation, and they look around and they say, where are the good men? Where are all the good women? And they're not to be found. Now, the reason why singles are looking more to the church, or Christian singles, for a partner is because they're getting married later. So traditionally, when people were getting married younger, they were looking for a spouse in college. Well, as people are no longer finding their spouse in college, they now look at the church to say, is my spouse here? And when that person is not found, they naturally feel disappointed, even if the church hasn't necessarily done something wrong in that way, but that's the felt experience. So all to say, in a nutshell, singleness can be very difficult. And again, part of the reason for this is many pastors and church leaders are alienated from the experience of singles. They are not aware of what it's like to remain single, prolonged into adulthood. So we are going to transition here and focus on understanding the emotional experience of being single as a first step to help singles find belonging in the church. So one night I was going through Facebook, and on my news feed, I noticed this post here. And an acquaintance said, I just clipped an article about online dating to Evernote. And Evernote is an information manager where you can store your audio, video, and text files. And she said, Evernote suggested that I might want to follow or file it under suffering and grief. Well played, Evernote, well played. And then another friend responded, that's some emotionally aware software. So Evernote gets it, that singleness is difficult. So we're going to look at a number of questions in particular that singles wrestle with, that's a part of making singleness so difficult. And we're primarily going to be looking at the experience of singles who desire marriage for this segment of understanding the emotional experience of singles, so predominantly those who desire marriage. One of the significant questions singles can wrestle with is, how am I perceived? This is a question of status, and Adam alluded to this in his experience in the church. So singles can be wondering, am I perceived as though my life is wonderful, and my life is easy, and people are envying me? Am I pitied? Is my life seen as less than or sad compared to others? Am I judged? The single, again, population, those who are divorced, are particularly prone to feeling judged in the church, feeling that they've done something wrong in getting divorced. Men can be judged for being commitment phobic. Women can be seen as immature to not be married. And it's really hard to wonder how you're being perceived. And this difficulty extends beyond the church. Even in society, both positive and negative stereotypes exist for what it means to be single. And these mixed messages actually make it more difficult to form a positive identity, because singleness is not so simple as only being positive or negative. And in fact, singleness is a deficit identity, meaning that singleness is an identity based off of what you don't have or the absence of something. So again, this question, how do others perceive my singleness, a question of status, is very difficult to wrestle with. Another difficult question is, why am I single?
So this is closely tied to the how am I perceived question. This is a question of, what is there a fact of the matter? It's a question of meaning. You know, what does my singleness mean? And it's almost never straightforward, the fact of the matter, why a person is single, at least completely straightforward, if they don't want to be single. And yet, as human beings, one of our chief needs is stories to explain our place in the world, and to some extent to the world. If you look at John 9, why was this man born blind? Was it because of his sins or the sins of his parents? Well, on one hand, what a terrible question, disciples. Criterion of embarrassment, way to go. But on the other hand, that's just so human. Well, there's got to be some explanation for this. This is terrible. Like, let's audit this and find the terrible thing this person did to explain this terrible situation. And as human beings, we will believe terrible, terrible lies about ourselves and other people if they help us make sense of the world. And none of us can really truly see ourselves. Everybody needs a mirror to see themselves, and yet mirrors are terrifying. We want to know, and we definitely don't want to know at the same time. What's the truth of this matter? So we're all desperately in need of the truth spoken in love.
I know this is a question I wrestled with deeply. Why am I single? What is wrong with me? What accounts for the fact that I'm even struggling to date? I remember watching friends date multiple people before I would even have a boyfriend. I remember watching a friend get married, get divorced, get married again before I even had a boyfriend. And so really, a very painful, difficult struggle of why. Why am I single? What accounts for this? What is my problem? Sometimes, unfortunately, people in the church can respond with alienating cliches, such as, when you're satisfied and content, God will bring the right person along. This is problematic because it communicates that it's not okay to be suffering or struggling in singleness, that you're supposed to be content. And it's offering the reason of why you're single is because you're not content, as though if you could manipulate your emotions and get to a content place, and all of a sudden a spouse would come along. And that's just not the case.
How did you feel when you met me?
Yes. I would actually say, when I was introduced to Adam, I was at the pinnacle of suffering and disappointment and confusion and angst. And it was absolutely not when I was content when I met Adam.
Although, since meeting me, she's experienced far greater disappointment. At times.
Our next question here, and I feel like this can actually be the most difficult question that singles struggle with. How long will I be single? So this is a question of time. Is singleness temporary, or is it permanent? Someone could meet their potential spouse tomorrow, even today, or never. And there will never be closure to a fact of you will never have a spouse. That God will never tell someone you will never get married. So it's very difficult to live in prolonged uncertainty, and this can become a struggle of hope. How do I remain hopeful for something that's unpromised to me? It can be very painful to keep hope alive. And in the midst of the uncertainty, not knowing and never having closure on if you will get married or not can become a strong preoccupation. You can become very preoccupied with this question of how long is it? Will I find this person or will I not find this person? The single again population can struggle with, will there be a mother or father figure present for my children, particularly if they've lost a spouse to death or if they're divorced and the other previous spouse is out of the picture, wondering, are my children ever going to have a mother or father figure present again? The cliche here, I believe God will have someone better for you soon. This is so problematic. I remember in 2006 in the church, there was a lady in the church who told me, you know, Kelly, I just really think there's going to be someone soon for you. I got married in 2016, a decade later. I also remember a family member telling me in 2009, you know, Kelly, I think it's just going to happen soon. Again, many, many years later. So, in my understanding, God does not gossip. He does not tell someone else about what's going to happen in your life. And in fact, giving someone false hope, hope that is not from God, steals suffering. Yes, suffering is painful and difficult, but if this is where God has positioned someone in a difficult situation of uncertainty, it's better to allow them to suffer, to enter in and to be present with them as they suffer, than it is to give them false hope. So again, false hope steals suffering. I am so thankful personally how my counselor sat with me very well and did not steal my suffering. He did not give me false hope and allowed me to suffer and wrestle with God, as that's where God positioned me. Now, there are some people who will take in this false hope, and that's not healthy for their souls, as I alluded to. And there's others who are very aware of, you can't tell me that you don't know if God has someone for me or not. And if you tell someone that you believe that God has someone for you soon, you're going to alienate yourself to them. It's problematic. Now, I think I understand why people in the church in particular are prone to saying these types of false promises because, particularly for those who are, say, older, so say 50, 45 and above, they look around and they know that many of their peers got married, that just about everybody got married, and so they imagine that it's true. They imagine that it is just a matter of time for this person to find a spouse. And these individuals aren't necessarily aware of how demographics are changing and this shift that people are getting married later or not getting married at all. So it comes from a well-intended place, even though it's not helpful. So how can you help singles with this question as they're wrestling with how long will I be single for? Something that was said to me that was very helpful was, I'll hold your hope. I'll hold hope for you as I was wrestling with hope. Or offer to help singles create what I call a little H hope plan, or things that they can do to try to get unsingle.
Yeah, so I'd like to add to that and emphasize for both of these cliches, they really might be well-intentioned, but they are pretty extraordinarily harmful. The first cliche will happen when you least expect it. It encourages people to manipulate and deceive themselves. And one might even say it encourages people to attempt to manipulate God for some sort of outcome. The second cliche, I believe God will have someone for you, I would ask a person offering that, really, are you a prophet? Is that the word of prophecy? Because if it's not, I invite you to consider the scripture and our church history's tradition of dealing with false prophets. And why have we been so harsh, maybe we shall say, with false prophets? It's because, well, I would say that the entire purpose of the church is to give people true hope. That's what the church is for, giving people true hope. And when you give people false hope, you're wearing away the foundation of the church's authority, trustworthiness, ability to communicate things and be believed, and you're taking something from that person who might be less able to believe, might be less able to receive true hope as a result of having salt water mixed with pure, as it were.
So another question that singles wrestle with is, how can I get unsingled? And this is a question of power. Do I have power to change my single status, or do I not? And the answer is somewhere in between. It's not that there's nothing someone can do to avail themselves of dating and marriage, but it's not as though it's a formula and they can certainly have immediate power to change the situation. Mystery of attraction. Understanding how attraction works in romantic relationships is really confusing and difficult as well. The single again population is often struggling with the question of how much time is okay to give to dating when I have children at home, for example. How much time is okay to give to getting unsingle? And I also want to remind you that not every single person is wanting to get unsingle. Some people are happy and content in their single state here. Alienating cliches, you're doing too much, you don't have time for a relationship, or you need to start getting more involved. Neither of these ideas tend to be helpful. What has been helpful to me, or was helpful, is a book called How to Get a Date Worth Keeping by Henry Cloud. How to Get a Date Worth Keeping, incredibly helpful, practical book on ways to work through internal experiences that may be holding you back from dating and practical ways to start dating. In fact, this book actually offers a refund if you're not dating in 6 months. So we consider these four questions that are difficult for singles. The question of perception, how am I perceived? This is a question of status. Why am I single? This is a question of meaning. How long will I be single? This is a question of time. And finally, what can I do to get unsingle? A question of power. There's a common thread that runs between all of these questions. And that common thread is ambiguity. Ambiguous situations are situations that are not clear. It's hard to give an answer. There's not a clear and straightforward answer to any of these questions. And for humans, ambiguity is very problematic. Do you know that ambiguity is what is underneath why clowns are so scary? It's because a clown face is not quite human. It's ambiguous. What face is a clown? It's not human. Ambiguity also undergirds social awkwardness. Ambiguity of it's not clear how to behave or act in a social situation. We tend to not like awkwardness as people. In the education sphere, assignments that are ambiguous are not clear. Students do not perform as well. And ambiguity is actually not helpful in food. So I remember when Adam and I were dating, he had attended a wedding of a friend, and he was talking about his experience at the wedding and how it was, and I asked him how the food was, and he said, you know, the chicken, it tasted kind of Hawaiian, Mexican, I couldn't tell if it was barbecue, and I said, well, it sounds like it was ambiguous chicken. And that was a problem, that even the taste was not clear, and we didn't like that. So ambiguity is very difficult for humans to handle, and that is at the core experience of singleness, is wrestling with these questions that are ridden with ambiguity. And in fact, singleness meets the criteria for a particular type of loss, and that is called ambiguous loss. In the counseling literature, ambiguous loss, there's two types, but I'm going to focus on the type that's relevant to singleness. And that is the loss of someone being psychologically present in your mind, but physically absent. So when someone desires, longs for, and hopes for a spouse, this person is present in their mind, but they're physically absent in their life. And it's hard to actually name what is lost as this person is psychologically present and physically absent, because this hoped-for person could be found tomorrow or never found. So it makes it very hard to name
and thus grieve the losses that are inherent to ambiguous loss. So to offer greater clarity to what I'm talking about here, if you have a spouse who, or a parent who's gone missing in action, this is an ambiguous loss. That person who's gone missing in action remains psychologically present in your mind, but physically absent in the family, and you're constantly wondering, is this person going to be found or not? And without the closure of death, that loss remains active and alive on a daily basis. And so this is the loss of singleness for those who desire marriage. Research shows that individuals who are grieving ambiguous loss struggle to do this because of the lack of clarity, that the grieving process is stunted, and that people rapidly cycle through the stages of grief, unable to find a point of closure, again, because the loss is ongoing. And an outcome of struggling with the grieving process is heightened levels of anxiety and depression. So it's really, really difficult to walk through and struggle with an ambiguous loss. So as you think about relating with singles who desire marriage, and you're wondering how to interact with them, you can consider that they are going through an experience akin to the suffering of the absence of a family member. And so you can consider, how might you respond to someone if they had a spouse or parent who had gone missing in action, or a child who was missing? You would really validate their pain and struggle, and you would give them lots of space to grieve. And you would not give them simple, easy answers.
So, with that cheerful snapshot of the state of singleness, what do we do? What then do we do? How then should we live? Given the ambiguity of singles' experience and even the diversity of singles' experience, it can seem like a challenge to even definitively define what's going on, much less coming up with a strategy to respond to it. So my suggestion and deeply held personal belief is that it's not so much coming up with a good list of to-dos and to-don'ts, although that can be a very helpful list, and we hope we've given you kind of one of them in your hand right now. But that's probably not what's most important. What's most important is being a certain type of person, as a church being a certain type of people. And I would suggest the type of person that is listening companions. So advice is not going out of style, right? There's always going to be people giving advice, good and bad. Nothing's going to stop that. Even people not even remotely asking for it is not going to stop that. And people need truth. People need to be told what's true. They need to be reminded of that if they forget. But, again, I don't know that anyone is necessarily in danger of not being able to get good advice, particularly if they look for it. What we might not be able to get, what a lot of people don't have, are people who can listen to them well and companion them well, particularly in these situations that they themselves do not understand. And I think God himself is our model in this. Romans 8 says this: in the same way the Spirit helps us in our weakness, we do not know what we ought to pray for, but the Spirit himself intercedes for us through wordless groans. And he who searches our hearts knows the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for God's people in accordance with the will of God. So God himself knows what we need and what we ought to pray for, and what does he do with it? Well, he doesn't tell us. That's kind of interesting. Yeah, oftentimes he doesn't tell us. What he does is he intercedes for us with wordless groans. Fascinating that what we need most is not to be told what the problem is, or what to do about it, or even what to ask God for. But that God meets us in a place that's far more spacious than that. And it's also interesting that, you know, all the problems in the world, also fairly complex and ambiguous, what was God's response to that? Well, it was to become God with us. Right? It was to join us in that. It was not to go through them one by one and fix them, which a lot of the time I would prefer to God with us, if I'm completely honest. But this is what God has done. He's given us himself to be with us, and not necessarily to problem solve, particularly in ways that we would like. So, yeah, I think that the solution, if we even want to call it that, is to try and be conformed to the mind, the will, the character of Christ, to follow the Spirit's lead in listening and companioning people. And I think in this process, as we consider what is it to be a good companion, a good listener, offer truth when it's apt, a good distinction can be made here between wisdom and discernment. Now, I hope this is not a new concept to any of you, because I'm not thrilled with my explanation of it. So I hope this intersects something you already know and understand well. But wisdom is what I would call the good advice. You know, all the advice that you give to people. Oh, well, you should do this and you should do that. Again, we're just focusing on good advice here. You know, there is such thing as good advice, right? There are such things as principles. Wisdom deals with ideals and principles. Wisdom is proverbs. These are things that are true most of the time. And most of the time, if you do this, this is the result, right? Important, and I hope you've heard this, proverbs are not promises, right? Raise up a child in the way you should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Not a promise, right? It's a proverb. That's what normally happens. These things are normative, okay? Ordinary providence. If you want to think in terms of theological terms, ordinary providence. Wisdom is impersonal, right? It doesn't care who you are, you know? It's non-biased, as it were. I would call the key question of wisdom, how did God set up the universe to function in cases like these? Which again is an excellent question, and one which Christians have an excellent answer to. We have the scriptures and the traditions of the church, and those are wonderful foundations and frames in which to present wisdom and to wrestle with these questions. Discernment, on the other hand, it's not so different, but it's not the same thing. I like to say that wisdom and discernment are kind of like grace and truth. You never really get one without the other. Discernment is applied wisdom in a sense. It's lived experience, okay? Discernment deals with exceptions to the rules. What happens when things don't go the way they normally should? Job is a book about discernment in some ways, right? Job's friends were thinking only in terms of wisdom and were not very discerning. And did not speak well of Job or God as a result. There was a warning in there for us. Discernment is only personal. There's no such thing as impersonal discernment. It only deals with the person and the situation they're in. And I think the questions of discernment are, God, what are you doing in this person right now? Spirit guiding. Really, we're seeking to join with the Spirit as He intercedes for people with wordless groans, as He companions people. We're taking our cue from the living and active Spirit, as opposed to, just the wisdom generally that God has established. So these are some thoughts, particularly relevant as we're about to delve in very briefly to some more practical situations. The practical suggestions we're giving, we believe, are consistent with wisdom, but need to be applied with discernment. So the first set of practicals, and again, all these, we're only covering a couple of each of these. The first two on each slide are planned due to time considerations, but they're all written on your handout. The first thing we suggest is relational. Okay, how can we be relationally the kind of people we need to be? Well, our suggestion is as a ministry leader, or really anyone in the church, have space in your life for single friends. Again, easier said than done. Have space in your life for X, easier said than done. But the key word here, I would say, is hospitality. Now, this actually applies to both marrieds and singles. It's very honoring, if counterintuitive, to invite a person into the real reality of your life, however chaotic and ugly it is. It's very honoring. I am constantly being apologized to by families with young children for whatever. We're sorry for the kid. We're sorry for the noise. We're sorry for the mess. We're sorry for the... I'm like, thank you for inviting me into the reality of your life. You know, I feel bad that they would need to apologize for that, and I would feel bad for single friends who would have to say, I'm sorry, I'm sad. You know, I'm sorry, I'm still sad. I'm sorry, I'm still stuck. You don't need to be sorry. You know, I'm honored to be shown the reality of this. Now, there's a danger in hospitality of trying to pull someone else into your own orbit. Nobody wants to be a planet in someone else's orbit, or no healthy person. Yes, we want to be invited in, but these things need to be a two-way street. Can't always be hearing about your problems, married or single. A real robust, healthy relationship goes both ways.
And I would also encourage you to think about setting up singles who would like to receive setups. So if you know two singles and you think they would make a great pair, check in with a single person and see if they would like to be set up. And if you do talk to someone about a possible setup, be sure to follow through and actually create the setup. And if you're no longer able to create the setup for whatever reason, circle back and close the loop to the single person who was waiting with hope and expectation of that possible setup. I know that was a time very difficult for me when I'd be very hopeful that there's going to be a setup and the person would not follow through and I would be left waiting and wondering. Setups are actually the impetus for my parents' marriage. You see the man on the right. He is responsible for setting up my parents. The lady on the left is responsible for setting up Adam and I. So my personal life misses a mission to be responsible for 5 setups in my life. I'm at 1. We'll see how that goes. But very practical way.
Well, a sign-up sheet.
That's right. Very practical way to help people. But make sure you check in and you find out that someone would like to receive a setup first. Practicals from the pulpit. I found it very helpful in my church when the infertility of singleness was recognized on Mother's and Father's Day. So Mother's and Father's Days tend to be celebrated in the church, and we are thankful for parents. We celebrate this. Many pastors do a great job of recognizing the pain of Mother and Father's Days for those couples who are infertile, and singleness is another type of infertility for those who desire marriage. And so to recognize that, my church did that, and it was very helpful.
Another thing, and this is a bit more comprehensive, I think, don't make marriage and family an idol. I would say be careful with the picture you paint of the good life. You know, the church is always painting a picture of the good life, whether it intends to or not. It's always painting a picture of the kingdom of God is like. And it can be challenging if the kingdom of God is like a married couple, a married couple, a married couple, a couple of kids, a family, a family, a family. Obviously, it's not communicated so explicitly, but implicitly, that can be the message. And after hearing that message over and over and over again, singles can wonder, well, if that's what the kingdom of God is like, where do I fit in the kingdom of God? If this is what the good life is, well, where is that for me? Do I just not have the good life? Am I one of God's forgotten children? So I would say it's important to communicate a picture of the good life that's faithful to the scriptures and what the kingdom of God is actually like. This can not always be fun. For example, one of the best examples of this that I've heard was a pastor who said, and it was apropos of what he was talking about, that we never reach a point in this life where loneliness can never touch us. We never reach a point in this life where loneliness can never touch us. That's absolutely true, because this life is not the place of shalom. That's important, I think, to paint an accurate picture of a good life and one that's inclusive of singles. Wrapping up real quick here, because we want to leave a little time for questions. Now, this again, is a place of discernment. Depending on the scope of your church, it would be great to have events of a size where singles can actually host the event. It can be their event, and they can invite other people. Inclusivity is wonderful, but it can actually rankle to always be the one who's included and the one not be the one who ever has the opportunity to include others. It's great to give people that opportunity to show hospitality instead of just receive it.
Another practical suggestion for worship is to have songs that offer lyrics of lament and suffering so that those who are struggling can find connection with God in that place at church. My church did this well. There were songs of glory and hope and excitement, and there were songs of sorrow, of pain, and lament. So make sure that your worship music is varied to give people different opportunities to connect emotionally with God.
So in summary, there are more singles than ever before. There's a great variety of differences in how people are single and the way they experience their singleness. Undesired singleness in particular can be a great source of suffering and grief. And our suggestion is the best thing we can do is to be good listeners, to follow the leading of the Spirit in this regard, be good listening companions, ask rather than assume, and seek to know and be in relationship with people as robustly as you would if they were married.
So we hope that our time this morning has helped you to have a better understanding of what singleness can be like, and ultimately to use this understanding to help singles find greater belonging in your church.
I believe we are out of time, but if you have any questions, feel free to come up and ask us personally, and our emails are right here if you'd like to correspond. Thank you all so much.
Yes, thank you so much for